Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Venus is often called Earth's twin, sometimes our evil twin, because its atmosphere is so toxic. How could it be otherwise, though, when it has had so many powerful volcanoes erupting, often in close succession? We're going to explore volcanoes for a bit here on Constant Wonder, from the weird to the otherworldly, like, you know, on Venus. We have with us volcanologist and author Robin George Andrews. His latest book is Supervolcanoes: What They Reveal About Earth and the Worlds Beyond. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, we are going to get to Venus, but first, I would like to get to know you a little better, because I understand you're one of those people who grew up to do what you've loved since you were a kid. And I want you to tell me how a video game inspired you to become a volcanologist.
Yeah, so I don't know where I got it from, but I was always wary of, I think adulthood is largely a trap. So I grew up playing video games. My parents let me play them a lot, and I still play them now. I love them. And there's a very well-known video game series called The Legend of Zelda, and they're pioneering 3D worlds, you know, back to 25 years ago, where you can wander around and travel through time, and it's all very magical and marvelous. And in one of these games called The Ocarina of Time, which came out when I was 10 years old, there's a volcano in it called Death Mountain, which is obviously a great name for a volcano. I mean, you know, can't really pick a better name than that. Yeah, it's full of like weird sentient lava, like flaming lizard creatures and monsters, and it's like really hollow on the inside, and it's nothing like a real volcano at all. But who cares? I was like, what? That's a thing? Volcanoes are a thing? You know, growing up in the UK, you don't really think about volcanoes that much. It's not what we're known for. So I sort of wondered about this, and I was like, oh, hold on. These exist in the real world, and jumped onto the internet as soon as I could and realized like, wow, there are volcanoes everywhere, and they look amazing, and they like, you know, they're the stuff of fantasy made real, sort of thing. And really, from that point onwards, I was like, that's it. I'm just going to do volcanoes somehow. I had no concept of what a job was or anything. I was like, I'm sure someone must do these things, you know, in their life. So someone must do it. You know, people go into space, for goodness sake. So surely someone at least climbs fiery mountains and goes, oh, look, melty things. And I was just... it was just the appeal of the absurd of it, you know, just to say that's what you do. I very, very stubborn, and I just kind of went with that as far as I could.
It doesn't sound like you've lost any enthusiasm from when you were 10 years old. And I'm so excited to have you to share that with us today. I want to start with maybe what is the world's strangest volcano? And I can't even say its name, but it's in Tanzania.
Yes, Old Doinyo Lengai, the volcano that erupts black lava that's more fluid than water. It's the weirdest volcano in known to science. It's super weird.
Why black?
Well, actually, it's people have been trying to work this out for ages, but it's not only black, it's actually really cold for lava. So lava is normally like 900, 1,000 degrees Celsius, so like 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. This is something like 400 degrees Celsius, maybe 500. So it's weirdly cold. It's the only lava that I've ever heard of that someone's fallen right into it and survived. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't recommend it. But,
yeah, you still.
yeah, but still, that's a weirdly incredible thing. You can swim out of lava and survive. I mean, anyway, it's crazy. And the reason it's black is it's because it's made of, it's like plumbing some really weird chemistry from like the heart of the planet. And it's basically the equivalent of, you know, like the lime scale stuff that you get inside kettles or around taps, that white chalky stuff.
It's hard
that,
water.
But lava. Mm-hmm. Yeah, hard water. It's that, but lava. And scientists are still not quite sure why it does that. And it's the only volcano in the universe that we could see so far that does it. So it's not just unique to Earth. It's unique to every other planet that we've ever seen. So that is really, that's a pretty good candidate for the weirdest volcano.
And you have a colleague, I guess, speaking of swimming out of something, she was willing to take that risk. She was going to rappel into the crater. I don't think she ended up doing it, but tell us that story, because that just seems like just a bridge too far to me.
Oh, I don't know. This is why. So I originally wanted to be a volcanologist before becoming a science journalist. I'm just really impatient. So I like writing and telling stories rather than doing the science. But every now and then I hear a story of oh, how did you get lava out of this crater? And the crater is as deep as the Statue of Liberty, I think, if I remember correctly. And the only way to get down into it, because it's so steep, is to kind of set up an abseil essentially across the middle so you can wind down a device to capture this lava and scoop it up. And you think that device would be really complicated. You know, everyone has this image of scientists being like really high tech. Nope, turns out the best thing to scoop up really strange alien lava is cocktail shakers, because they don't melt under the temperatures of this lava. And they scooped up portions of this lava, this black lava, and then sort of hang it out to dry like beef jerky before they kind of collected it. And that's as high tech as it gets. But yeah, to do that, they had to balance on the edge of this volcano. And if you're clumsy, you either would have fallen down off the side of this volcano or fallen into it. So it's not, I guess volcanology is not a place for clumsy people like me.
We're speaking with Robin George Andrews about his book, Supervolcanoes, What They Reveal About Earth and the Worlds Beyond. Now, I want to talk about that term supervolcanoes, because I guess it actually is a technical term. And I've been to Yellowstone, as I'm sure many of our listeners probably have. And I still remember the feeling of kind of awe or fear when the rangers explained that the mountains that I saw in the distance were actually the edge of the caldera, you know, the rim of a volcano, and the whole park is inside the volcano. And that's really freaky feeling. So I just like you to talk to us just a little bit about what a supervolcano actually is.
Right. Yeah. So the word supervolcano has got a weird reputation. And I got to think that most people see, understandably, the idea of a supervolcano, the most powerful volcano kind of you can get, as like nature's weapon of mass destruction. Like at some point, it's just going to go off and we're all doomed. Mm-hmm. It's actually nowhere near as scary as that. Even though, so a supervolcano like Yellowstone, all that means is at some point in its existence, and these volcanoes have existed for like millions of years, it's created an eruption that's launched like 240 cubic miles of volcanic matter into the sky, which is a lot. Like, I'm not going to, like, these eruptions are big. These are not things that you would hear, you would notice. These are the sort of things that if it was going to happen, scientists would be running around screaming, waving their arms, you know. But they're not doing that because they're not particularly worried about this sort of thing, because these events are so infrequent that, you know, most of the time Yellowstone has just erupted a bit of lava, or there's been a little hydrothermal explosion, like, you know, with this pressurized water. So Yellowstone has had two super eruptions in the last 2.1 million years. The idea that it's overdue, it's not true. In fact, the hotspot that's fueling Yellowstone is kind of it's moving on. So Yellowstone is very slowly dying. So the best way to think about it is it's like an Olympic athlete. You know, it might get gold once or twice in its career, but then it normally retires. So it's Yellowstone exploding and destroying the world, which it wouldn't do anyway. It's not something that I would spend my day worrying about. You know, you wouldn't bet money on it happening during your lifetime sort of thing. It's not a 0% chance, but it's not something to be feared. But at the same time, as you say, you can stand there and see the edge of the cauldron that you're standing in, and the epic scale of these things is so impressive. You know, when Yellowstone had its first super eruption 2.1 million years ago, it was like the sky was falling, like the ground would have cracked open. It would have been like rivers would have flown backwards. Anything caught in its blast would have been vaporized. It sounds terrifying, but I don't know why. I just have this like, scientifically, that's weirdly fascinating that you can have these giant things that go on for years, and then for the rest of its life, it's just a beautiful natural park. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird thing.
Let's talk about another supervolcano. This one, I guess, is called Toba. Am I saying that right? In Indonesia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the thing I want to talk about that is you're describing how powerful these eruptions can be, but they found some evidence of survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that whole thing.
Yeah, so Toba, the most recent super eruption, again, just like a very big eruption. You know, if it erupted just slightly less, it would just be a regular eruption. So the word supervolcano is kind of a little silly, but it's very evocative. And 75,000 years ago in Indonesia, there was a super eruption. And the worry about super eruptions is that they can briefly and very severely cool the climate, which can create all kinds of environmental catastrophes. And the ash can create feet of ash, you know, it would kill off agriculture. And humans are around back then. And so it's the only super eruption that humans have been around for. So that shows you how infrequent they are. You know, mm-hmm. humans have been around for 400,000 years, give or take, modern humans. So in fact, there's only been one. Shows you how little you should worry about it day to day. Anyway, there was this theory for a while that this eruption was so epic and awful that basically it almost wiped out humanity, and people pointing to some evidence like, oh, there aren't many, there's a genetic bottleneck which suggested there weren't many humans around at the time. That slowly got debunked. And the bit that really hit home was a series of like archaeology studies in India, which found that there was just like all this ash had built up in India. And this obviously is quite far away from Indonesia. So the ash went everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they thought, surely, you know, there's artifacts under this layer of ash are older than the eruption, and they expected to find no artifacts above the layer of ash, because if it's really deadly, no one would have survived, right? But right. They just found the same artifacts right above the ash, exactly the same, made by the same people. And when they actually worked out who built these artifacts, it was Homo sapiens. So it was us. So 75,000 years ago, before we had any technology, before we had any scientific understanding of volcanoes in any way, humanity did just fine when there was a super volcanic eruption. You won't want to be next to it. You won't want to be in the same region. But if you're in the rest of the world, you'd be fine. So the idea of a super volcano like ending the world is just myth, really. It's just like, I think volcanoes have a bad PR problem.
Well, Robin George Andrews, I see that you are doing your best to correct that.
Yes.
Robin George Andrews' latest book is Supervolcanoes, What They Reveal About Earth and the Worlds Beyond. So where are underwater volcanoes located? Everywhere, or are they in a particular place? And how did we find them?
Well, it's kind of amazing. They are kind of everywhere in a way. Just, you know, Earth is really a planet of underwater volcanoes. You know, us surface dwellers only see a tiny portion of the planet. And Turns out the ocean is really good at hiding stuff. It's almost annoyingly good at hiding stuff. So everyone wanting to find the good stuff, which is at the bottom of the ocean, they have to send like robots to dive down and everything. But yeah, there are underwater volcanoes. If you add up their area, it's the same size of Russia and Europe combined. It's a really big part of the underwater oceans, and they're mainly concentrated along this sort of rift system where the Earth's tectonic plates being torn apart. And this rift system, which is mostly underwater, is 40,000 miles long. It arcs all the way around the planet, and you just have lava erupting all along this huge rift system. It's the world's longest chain of volcanoes, but then you also have mountains, volcanoes just pop up here and there, and they're kind of everywhere, really. It's kind of remarkable that someone hasn't turned into a supervillain and gone, well, I'm building a fortress out of that. There's so much real estate.
I want you to tell us about Marie Tharp. And this is actually mm-hmm. not a humorous story. And I want to give her credit where credit is due, because she didn't get it in her lifetime. But she was really instrumental in identifying these underwater volcanoes.
Yeah, so Marie Tharp really is the reason we know that the world is a lot more volcanic and a lot more geologically alive than anyone gave it credit for. So she was just someone who had like Jedi-like instincts for what she did. But because she lived in the 50s and 60s, there was just a huge pushback from almost all the men she worked with. And she basically joined Columbia University in the late 1940s. And she was just assigned to kind of draw, like do really monotonous, like join the dots for these like sonar profiles of the Atlantic. And, you know, boats would go over and send a noise down and get that reflection, try and work out like, is there a mountain there? Is there not a mountain there? And as she joined up these dots, she essentially found that there's a huge rift valley and a mountain range going through the middle of the Atlantic. And every time she kind of said, hey, I think this is a point at which like the, you know, these plates are like being torn apart and this huge sort of volcanic region, she was just dismissed for ages. In fact, one of her colleagues said that it was girl talk, which is probably, I mean, there's never a good use of that horrible phrase, but that's probably one of the dumbest examples I can think, because you're literally presenting scientific evidence. And it took a lot of convincing, but every time they added more data and joined the dots up and found this valley-sized mountain range, they were like, oh, but maybe. And eventually she just convinced her peers. But, you know, she, throughout her career, she was never first author on scientific papers. She wasn't allowed to go on research cruises for some reason. You know, no women were. And when the results were presented at conferences and things, you know, her name was often left out. And it was the men that took the credit for the work that she really pioneered, you know. So it took a long time for people to recognize what she did. And amazingly, she just persisted. I'm amazed that she did through the decades, just carried on doing her work and quietly revolutionizing, you know, science as she did.
And what kind of work do volcanoes under the ocean do? I mean, do they erupt, and does it change geology any? I mean, is it creating land, destroying land? I mean, do we feel the evidence of these explosions up here on the surface?
Sometimes. And it's really great when that happens, because it's quite a spectacular thing that rarely harms anyone. So if a volcano is feeling a bit lonely under the ocean, and it erupts explosively enough, you can actually build islands up. Like an island in the 60s just appeared off the coast of Iceland because a volcano erupted so furiously that it just built enough land to withstand the waves. The entire Hawaiian archipelago is volcanic in nature. You know, a lot of the land that we live on is built on a foundation of eruption. So the world would be a lot smaller without volcanoes. Very, very small, in fact. It probably wouldn't be recognizable as Earth at all. But even if these volcanoes just quietly and politely erupt underwater and we don't get to see them, they are home to all kinds of almost alien life. You have strange microbes that don't need sunlight. You have animals that basically wait for, you know, big fish to swim through these plumes of toxic volcanic material. They die, the fish fall down, and then they just have dinner. They have a banquet sort of thing. So you even have sharks living inside active volcanoes, and scientists have no idea why they would want to do that. But clearly sharks like to live dangerously. But yeah, volcanoes are... Underwater volcanoes, like their surface counterparts, are equally destructive and constructive. You wouldn't want to live without them, but you don't want to get too close.
All right, well, let's get far away from volcanoes on Earth and go to Mars, because I understand that there are some of the largest volcanoes in the solar system on Mars.
Yes, like outrageously large. Like, you know, it puts Earth to shame.
Tell us about how they erupt. They erupt like volcanoes on Earth, or is there something different?
Mm-hmm. No. They. So basically, the volcanoes on Mars are sort of like Kilauea, just gone into overdrive. So they erupt. They used to erupt very fluid lava. Mars is kind of an almost volcanically dead world now. It's very tiny, so it lost all the heat it had inside. So without that heat, it can't really make any more volcanoes. But back in the day, a couple of billion years ago, it used to erupt lava floods so frequently that it could bury the United Kingdom in a couple of weeks. And, you know, it was just very good at making lava. And the difference between Mars and Earth is Earth has tectonic plates, you know, these sort of jigsaw pieces that keep moving on the surface of the world. So when you have these plumes of super hot material that come up from the Earth's like molten heart and just act like a blowtorch on the surface, the tectonic plate keeps moving. So you get chains of volcanoes. On Mars, for some reason, it never had plate tectonics. It just has one big shell. So when it has these plumes coming up, it just keeps acting as a blowtorch at that exact same point. It just keeps melting things and melting things. On Earth, the biggest volcano we have is about 2,000 square miles at its base. Pretty big. That's pretty big. You could squash any city you like with that. But on Mars, you have Olympus Mons, which is a ludicrously massive volcano. It's three times higher than Everest. And it's as wide as the state of Arizona. But even that pales in comparison to something called Tharsis. Tharsis is like a giant magmatic volcanic pimple on the side of Mars. And it's three times the size of America. And it grew so big so quickly that it tipped Mars over. I think it's my favorite thing to tell people. Like, a volcano got so big, the planet tipped over, which is like being... in London and suddenly moving to the North Pole. No. You know, same with New York and suddenly moving to the North Pole. The Sahara Desert suddenly moving to, you know, Paris. It's an insane thing. Normally it takes planets crashing into planets to tip planets over. Mars just tipped itself over because it got a bit carried away.
And when did this happen, and who recorded it tipping?
So it happened. It happened a few billion years ago, really. People are still trying to work out, you know, exactly the timing of it. But it turns out that Mars once had rivers and ocean. There's an ocean in its north end. It used to be the red planet. Used to be a blue planet to some degree. And people are still debating as to how blue it was. Mm-hmm. But it certainly had oceans everywhere. And oceans, as you would expect, have shorelines. And it turns out that Tharsis, this massive volcanic pimple, was so big that it actually deformed the surface of Mars. It was like, it's like dropping a cannonball onto like a bowl of custard or something, or you know, onto a trampoline. Mm-hmm. The whole surface rippled because this volcano got so big. And it turns out that scientists are clever enough that they actually could almost like reverse time to see what the original coastline and shores and what the planet should have looked like without this volcano being there. So they kind of did some detective work and they said, well, yeah, this this volcanic province just tipped Mars over. It actually couldn't get any bigger. If it got any bigger, it would have sunk back into Mars. So it's kind of, Mars is kind of like an extremist, I suppose. An extremist past its time.
All right, let's go from the extremist to the evil twin planet, Venus.
Yes.
And tell us why it's got such a bad rap.
Well, Venus and Earth, if Earth and Mars are cousins, planetarily speaking, you know, Mars is a bit smaller, it's a bit colder, it's a bit further away. Venus and Earth should be sisters because they're made of the same stuff. They're right next to each other. They formed pretty much at the same time. So it's pretty weird. The Earth is kind of paradisical, whereas Venus is the worst place you could possibly imagine. If someone was having a bad day, if there was an all-creating deity who was having like a horrible day, they were hungover, it was like a Thursday, and they had to make a planet, and they were in a bad mood, Venus is the planet they would make. If you walked across the surface of Venus, you would be simultaneously crushed, eaten alive by acid if you flew slightly high enough, and you'd burst into flames and melt. It's the worst place. It's like being in an oven a mile underwater. Absolutely horrible. So that's why people call it Earth's evil twin. It's like Earth, where something went horribly wrong. Someone like left the oven on for too long and everything burnt down. It's kind of amazing, actually.
And volcanoes are part of the cause of that problem.
Yes, so there's two theories about what happened to Venus. One is that the sun, being close to the sun, it was always a bit too hot. So the water it had, and it used to have an ocean's worth of water. You can see the chemical ghosts of that in the atmosphere. Maybe it was always so hot because the sun was just getting very excited in its youth, and it boiled off all the water. And water being a greenhouse gas meant that Venus was just always a hot, horrible place. But the leading theory now is that Venus was an ocean world like Earth, and perhaps for a short period of time, but perhaps for billions of years, maybe not that long ago, Venus used to have the equivalent of the Pacific Ocean there. Maybe it was full of life, but we don't know because somehow the whole surface turned into a melted apocalypse. And the main idea is on Earth, every now and then in its history, you get these epic eruptions. And by epic, I mean they take 2 million years to kind of complete, you know, million year scale eruptions. It's hard to imagine how long these eruptions go on for. There was one that happened 252 million years ago that triggered a global warming offensive that caused the worst mass extinction on the in Earth's history. It wiped out 90%+ of all species. Mm. And this eruption happened for 1 to 2 million years. And again, humans have only been around for about 400,000. So an eruption has happened on Earth that went on many times longer than our species has existed. The idea is on Venus, there have been maybe several of these at the same time. And that just caused the planet's climate to go so badly wrong with all this carbon dioxide and all this water vapor that the planet then couldn't adjust its thermostat back. It just lost control. And so it kind of entered a runaway greenhouse state and everything got very hot. Plate tectonics broke. You know, the Earth's machinery broke down. It couldn't get any colder. Volcanoes just started erupting everywhere. So it's like as apocalyptic as you'll get. And it only took one or two more of these eruptions happening at the same time. And that's the big question. And that's why it's called Earth's evil twin, really, because people don't know what's normal. Is Earth normal or is Venus normal? Should most planets our size turn into a volcanic hellscape or should they be like Earth? So when you hear in the news, oh, they found an Earth-like planet orbiting another star, they could be saying Venus-like planet. They don't know yet if it's more like Earth or more like Venus. So that's why they're sending so many missions to Venus now, because they want to know, is Venus unlucky or is Earth lucky? And I think that's the most fascinating question in all of, you know, planetary science at the moment.
Well, Robin George Andrews, I see that you have not lost any of your enthusiasm for volcanoes since you were 10 years old, and I am so grateful for it. There are so many more fun stories, great history, great geology in your book, Super Volcanoes, What They Reveal About the Earth and the World Beyond, Worlds Beyond. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Anything to boost the reputation of volcanoes, I'll happily do.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. More about hot lava coming your way here on the show. We are about to meet a volcanologist who takes a coffee can and a hammer along with her whenever she's at a flowing volcano. Well, why would she do that? You'll find out. You're listening to Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. I don't recommend that you travel to an actively flowing or spewing volcano, but if you choose to ignore my advice, you would want to be in the company of somebody like Jess Phoenix. She has been in just such places many times. You know, with a last name like Phoenix, and if you think about the mythological meaning of the bird, the phoenix, you might wonder if she would be just a little cavalier about getting burned. But actually, she's very savvy and cautious. I want you to hear part of a conversation with Phoenix. She's a geologist and co-founder of the environmental science nonprofit called Blueprint Earth, and she's author of Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. She likes to tell people that two of her favorite pieces of volcano equipment are a coffee can and a hammer.
So the coffee can and the hammer that you mentioned, that's actually one of my favorite scientific equipment duos, because if I've got both of those things, I'm going to go sample some lava. And I don't mean like lava that has solidified and is, you know, has been cooled for millions of years. This is active flowing lava that's about 2000 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's funny because we think, you know, we have so many high-tech tools. I mean, we can do gamma knives to help people with cancer, and we can land a rover on Mars. But, you know, if you want to go sample flowing lava to run the, you know, the lava itself through a mass spectrometer to understand the chemical composition, you know, the different elements and minerals that make up the lava, you need to collect a sample first. And that sample has to have all of the gases that are trapped inside the melt preserved inside. Otherwise, your reading's not going to be accurate. So you have to take a sample from an active flow. So we go up to the edge of the flow, and you have to make sure that you, this goes back to the clothes again, you've got to wear cotton. You can't wear any sort of synthetics, because unless it's specifically fire retardant, heat resistant synthetics, because, you know, things like leggings will melt when you're up to heat that's quite that intense. So you absolutely have to make sure that you're wearing your correct sampling clothing. And then you can't wear steel-toed boots, because, again, feet in metal, you don't want to encase your feet in metal when you're walking up to something that's four times hotter than the hottest setting on most ovens. And you do need heat resistant gear for your hands and for your face at the bare minimum. And as you approach the lava, you've got the rock hammer in one hand. And a rock hammer is special. It's not the hammer that you buy at the hardware store. It's one that's made of a single piece of drop forged steel. And what that means is the head won't separate from the handle. And so it's a much safer thing if you're going to use it to crack open hard rocks. And it also has a pick end on one side, at least the kind that volcanologists tend to use, has a sort of pointy end. And you approach the lava, you reach out with the pick end of the hammer, and you stick it into the molten rock. And as you pull it out, the whole time you're not really able to see what you're doing, because your eyes are dehydrating. So you're trying to shield your eyes behind sunglasses or safety goggles, either one. And you're using your heat resistant gloves to sort of protect your face. So you're sort of seeing what you're doing. But yet, once you realize, yep, I've got some tension here on the end of the hammer, you pull back and the lava becomes like a taffy. It's so weird to feel and witness, and no matter how many times I do it, it's never going to get old. And of course, it's an incandescent taffy that's super heated. And you then turn around and that's where the coffee can comes in. So that's where you filled it with just regular old water, no special thing about the water, but you turn and pull your little bleb. That is actually a scientific term. We call it a bleb of lava, but you take your little bleb of lava on the end of your hammer and you basically shake the lava off into the coffee can that's filled with water. And that hyper quenches the lava, meaning it preserves the gases and the minerals exactly as they are inside of the flow so that we can take it back to the lab. So of course, you know, you got room temperature water and you drop like 2000 degree lava in it, it's going to boil instantly. So it hisses, you've got the steam coming off of it. And, you know, then you scoot away from the flow where it's not so hot and you check out the sample that you've collected. And that is why coffee cans and rock hammers are indispensable field tools.
So real quick answer, how many times have you done this?
Oh, wow. Several dozen, I would say, all told. Sometimes just for the camera, sometimes for actual scientific purposes. It's something, though, that, I mean, you could ask me to do it for a dollar, I'd go do it. You'd ask me to do it for free, I'd go do it. Well, I mean, it's just the most incredible raw ability to experience nature as it's creating and destroying at the same time. And I mean, it's not safe, but it's relatively safe compared to other ways we interact with volcanoes. So I will take it anytime.
So I'm trying to compare to a task that I've had to perform where you have to get in and get out. And the best thing I can come up with right now is the idea when I was a kid, I'd go diving and seeing how long I could hold my breath. Is it one of those things where you have to psych yourself up for it? You prepare, you take a big breath of air and you say, here goes. And you kind of are in that mindset. Do you have to work up to it?
A little bit. And people who've played sports may relate to this because I played a ton of sports as a kid and I still do. I still play softball and ride horses. And it's sort of like right before you're about to do something momentous in the sport, the moment where you just go, all right, I'm as ready as I'll ever be. Let's go. And you're completely focused on the physical task at hand. I mean, you could be the world's greatest genius and none of that matters. All that matters is your ability to go in there, not get distracted, to not get worried if you do feel your eyes dehydrating, which is disconcerting at best, and to just get in and get out and do so in a way that keeps you and anyone else who might be there safe.
Well, why don't they have stunt people do this for you?
I mean, I keep saying to people on all my TV shows, because, you know, you hear directors and actors talk about stunts and stunt doubles and things. And I say, well, I do my own stunts. And it's true, because as scientists, there isn't often budget to have anyone else go out. So a lot of times scientists learn how to do these skills that are pretty highly specialized. And like I was just listening to NPR about the discovery of some more scrolls in the desert and, you know, that were related to the Bible and biblical times. And they were saying the archaeologists were rappelling down cliffs in the desert for several years. And I went, yeah, that sounds about right. So you learn things that you never would have expected to do. Like I now can rappel or abseil, as they call it in the European world. But I can do that now. And that's not anything that I've ever done for fun. Like I'm not a rock climber or anything, just as a, you know, for something casual. But I do it for work.
So are you at the point now where you could just look somebody straight in the eye and say, I'm pretty good at retrieving blebs?
Yes, I can say that with a straight face. And I can also tell people that I lick rocks for a living with a straight face. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but hey, it's where I am.
You let them cool off first, though.
Yes, obviously. Oh my God, do not lick a hot lava bleb ever. You will die. Well, you might not die, but you're going to wish you were dead.
Well, at some point you decided that this was really for you. And I've heard you tell a story where it was like, well, there's that moment, and I don't know if what you drove up the mountain. It was in Hawaii, I think, where you said, I could spend a lot of time with lava and be happy.
Yeah, I don't know when that exact moment occurred, but it may have been the very first time that I set foot on a volcano, like, you know, knowingly a volcano that is currently capable of erupting, not one, you know, back east that hasn't erupted in, you know, hundreds of millions of years. But one in Hawaii, and that was Mauna Loa. And we drove up at the time I was working, my boss at the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory was Frank Truesdell. He is a brilliant scientist and just a wonderful guy. And he and several other scientists and I, on my third day of working at the observatory, said, you know, he said, "Oh, we're going to go to the summit of Mauna Loa." And I'm like, "Whoa, okay." And the only ways to get up there are a car, like a very high clearance four-wheel drive vehicle with rock crawling tires, or helicopter. And the first time I went was via truck, and we took Frank's government issued Chevy Tahoe that he had, he took a hacksaw to cut the bumper off of it because, you know, the bumper was too low as it came from the factory, and he put rock crawling tires on it. So it was sort of a beast. And we went up over this thing that could barely pass for a road. It was full of, you know, jagged older lava flows. And we went to the summit. The other scientists were all men and all much taller than me. So they covered ground a lot more quickly than I did, because I was very inexperienced. There's a whole technique to walking on lava flows that you need to learn. And I didn't quite know it. They had to give me pro tips at that point. But when we hit the summit and they kept on walking because they'd been there before, I stopped like I'd hit a wall, because the sight was so overwhelming. And you may think, like, lava, oh, it's black or it's gray, and it just sort of sits there once it's done erupting, and it's blah. It's not blah. There are infinite variations of the color gray, and some are silver, some are reddish, some are very fresh looking, some look like they've been just weathered and are oxidizing, rusting, literally. And it's so vast. The summit of Mauna Loa is enormous. I mean, we're talking miles across, you know, both long and wide. And when you think about the fact that the earth you're standing on is younger than you are, something for me, at least, just clicked in my brain. And I went, the planet is alive. Earth is still changing and growing and evolving. And we're here for the ride. And how amazing is that?
Jess Phoenix is with us. Phoenix is author of Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. Jess, I was just about to ask you about lava tubes, and I have come, while hiking, within half a mile of a lava tube, but I had to turn around and go back, and this was a very, very ancient lava tube. But you've actually overnighted or slept or taken shelter in a lava tube?
Yes. And I should clarify that you're not supposed to. It's particularly if you're in Hawaii, because the lava tubes were often used as burial locations for Native Hawaiian people. Because if you think about it, the islands are entirely volcanic, so you don't have a lot of soil to dig down into to bury someone. So if you want to do that, you have to be creative. And their solution was to use lava tubes as people's final resting places. So if you're just a tourist and you're walking around Hawaii and you think you found a lava tube, don't go in it. You can go in the one that the Park Service has cleared in Hawaii Volcano National Park. That's fine. But we were doing an expedition that involved an overnight, and it was raining like crazy on the side of Mauna Loa. We were up at about 9,000 feet elevation. And, you know, it was either get the whole, you know, tent situation set up and hunker down. Or, again, my boss, Frank Truesdell, he's part Native Hawaiian. He said, all right, let's go in that lava tube. And I was with another young scientist, and we kind of looked at each other and we're like, we're not really supposed to go in there. And Frank goes, it's fine. It's fine. I'm Hawaiian. It's fine. So he said, get in the tube. And we got in the tube. And the reason, I mean, Hawaii, like any other indigenous culture, has a long and amazing history that's filled with different traditions, different things that you are or aren't supposed to do to either honor or disrespect spirits and deities. And in Hawaii, there is this, aside from just being disrespectful and, you know, not going into a place where somebody might have buried their ancestors, there's also this this legend of night marchers, which are the ghosts of warriors And if you encounter night marchers, they, of course, march around at night. You're supposed to lay face down on the ground if you're outside until they've passed, or go indoors. And of course, sleeping out in a lava tube, my brain started to click over to, oh God, are night marchers going to come? Like, are we gravely disrespecting somebody? And the funny thing is, I'm not superstitious about anything other than not pissing off volcano deities. So if somebody tells me, any culture around the world, whenever I go to work in a new place and there's volcanoes involved, and it's just a good thing to do, even if you research other areas, if you need to know what the local traditions are, because you don't want to be disrespectful. Sure. It's an honor to work in a lot of these places, an honor and a privilege. And so if you come from a culture, I'm pretty generic, you know, middle American, nothing too either forbidden or you know, amazing in our culture that we have to really watch out for, at least not the way I was raised. So when I go to other places, it's always a big learning experience. And I will not take rocks from volcanoes. It's very much frowned upon in Hawaii. And every year the Park Service gets like thousands of pounds of lava rock chunks mailed back from people who took samples, samples. They're not official samples, but they're souvenirs. And then they had bad luck.
Yeah, I was going to say, the night marchers showed up, didn't they?
Yes, the night marchers may have made an appearance, but you don't want to piss off Madame Pele, the volcano goddess of Hawaii, because she is a very giving deity, and that she creates new land for the Hawaiian Islands, but also can be very, very fiery when displeased.
Speaking of fiery, you've stepped on different types of lava at different temperatures. And is there a way to read it where you know, other than that's glowing? Or, I mean, how can you really know where you're going to get a good foothold?
Well, so if you're in an area where there's been an eruption, and of course there are different kinds of eruptions. So you get the oozy, runny kind, an effusive eruption, like you see in the Hawaiian Islands very typically, or you get a stickier, higher viscosity lava, and that tends to explode more. You see that in volcanoes like Mount St. Helens, for example. So if you've got an oozy, runny eruption, it's pretty easy to keep track of where the lava has been flowing, at least on the surface. You do have to watch out for what's going on beneath the surface, because you can have a lava tube that is formed in a current eruption. And basically, that's just a conduit, a tunnel for the lava to flow through that has cooler rock along the outsides. And it serves as like a chute for the lava to go downhill, essentially. So you don't want to be walking across like a cooled or partially cooled crust of lava without knowing that the ground beneath your feet is as solid as possible. It's something that's, you've got to be on your toes to look for, because sometimes the only clue you have, because lava flow fields can be very, very hot. They, you know, that the color of the lava being dark is very good at absorbing heat. So you feel everything's hot. And if you have to be reminding yourself all the time, pay attention to any increase in heat. If it's already really, really hot, it's hard to notice sometimes when it gets just a bit warmer, but that is something you need to pay attention to, because you may not see incandescence. You may not see like a little skylight that lets you peer down into the lava tube. So you could actually walk on the roof of a lava tube and it could collapse, and that would be it. So it just means that it pays to work with people who have been monitoring the volcano closely, both remotely via satellite and via on the ground or in the air observations, because you don't want to stumble into a lava tube. I mean, in any way, shape, or form, it could end badly.
Yeah. Now, here on this show, Constant Wonder, we've often talked about the various senses that we use for all the stimuli in the world around us. And I'm just wondering, if you're on a volcano, are you using your ears much? Are you using your nose much?
Yes. And actually, I didn't realize that was so central to the experience until I went to write my book. And you know, a lot of the work that we do, we take field notes. We were either making scientific measurements, or if you're out for a while, you may just jot down your thoughts while you're sitting in your tent at night, or if you're snowed in somewhere. So I relied a lot on notes that I had taken, or notes that my colleagues had taken, or blogs that I kept around the time that I was doing this work. But when I had certain things, certain moments that I wanted to talk about, the best thing I found was to close my eyes. And I'm very bad at visualizing. I just can't when it comes to, like, imagine a, I don't know, a taco. Like, I have a hard time seeing that picture in my head. And so when I wanted to conjure the feel of a place that maybe I'd only been once, or I'd been there, but it was very far removed from, you know, Los Angeles, where I live now, I would close my eyes and really think about, What did the wind feel like? What were the sounds that I heard? Because volcanoes make a lot of different noises, and lava flows often sound very glassy or very crumbly because there is a lot of silica in various lavas. So you get a real, like, a tinkly noise or a crunching noise. You'll sometimes smell sulfur, that rotten egg scent that a lot of us have associated with volcanoes. And sometimes you'll smell burning vegetation too. So every place that you get to physically go out into nature, if you can take a moment, close your eyes, and just notice what you're observing with your other senses, it'll help you recall it more clearly later on. So that's something that I've started to do now since I started writing all of this down, is to try to say, okay, what does the air taste like? You know, is there salt on the breeze? Are we near an ocean? Or is it stinky because I'm working next to a landfill? Because sometimes we do science next to landfills. So, you know, it's that sort of attention to detail that will make everybody's memories stronger when they go to these places that they may be once in a lifetime trips.
You just barely mentioned ocean water again. That reminds me of the bleb going into the water in the coffee can. And I'm just thinking about the border between land and sea, and lava sometimes shows up there or even under the ocean. That's got to be a completely different world where you're not just at near the summit of a volcano, but the interaction of the lava and the water must be just tremendously dynamic.
It really is. And I was lucky enough to get asked to go and film a Shark Week show for Discovery they originally told me it was going to be called Sharks and Volcanoes. And I thought, oh, amazing, because sharks are just my favorite. I like lions, sharks, and volcanoes. So I went, I don't think we can incorporate all three in the same segment, but okay, we can do sharks and volcanoes. And they had me paired up with a marine biologist, and we actually did scuba diving in the water fairly close to where Kilauea volcano was producing lava flows that entered the Pacific Ocean. And it was really fascinating because the same day we started by going to look at the ocean entry where the lava was going into the water. And it gave me a chance to educate the film crew and the marine biologist and explain what we were looking at as the lava, the plastic solid moving like a liquid, hit the seawater. You'd get laze, lava haze. That's a word. You would see that, and it would be largely acid gas rich. And so, of course, we wanted to keep the boat upwind of that, so no one was getting a lung full of acid gas. And we would see chunks of pumice, a very, very vesiculated. Vesiculated means it's got lots of little holes in it. So if you just imagine a chunk of rock with, like, Swiss cheese kind of a composition, that's what you see floating on the surface of the water. And the pumice would come towards the boat where we were filming. And it was pretty great because I was not just getting a chance to educate, but also keep people safe by saying, okay, we need to move back now. We're getting too close. And then shortly thereafter, I got to enter the marine biologist world, and we scuba dived, and we were, you know, while we were down, we were looking for any signs of sharks, and we deployed a camera trap that would help us see if there were any sharks near the active lava entry into the ocean. And when we came back up and had a chance to process it, we were sort of hypothesizing that sharks were maybe drawn to the warmer waters and then the additional nutrients that would be present in waters surrounding an active lava flow that would enter an ocean.
Are you getting greater acidity in those oceans close to where the lava flows are?
You know, we didn't do any specific measurements, but I would not be surprised if you saw a change in the chemical composition of the water. And as an interesting aside, I also got a chance to work not that long ago in Indonesia. And this is a fun thing to Google. So if your listeners can safely look this up, if they're not driving while they're listening, the volcano's name is Kawah Ijen, and it's K-A-W-A-H. And then the second word is I-J-E-N. In Javanese, that means the lonely one. And this volcano, it's a stratovolcano, so the pointy conical type. And it usually erupts pretty explosively. At the summit of this volcano, there's a crater. And in the crater is the world's largest acid lake. So this volcano has a magma chamber that's, we can't see it, obviously, it's below the surface. But gases are bubbling up essentially through cracks in the surface. And these gases, these hydrogen fluoride, hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide gases, are turning the water that is collected in this crater into something that is four times stronger than battery acid in terms of its acidity levels. So if you put a metal barrel in this water, it will start dissolving. And, you know, over a series of weeks to months, it will dissolve. It will be eaten away by the acid in this water. So yeah, volcanoes are extreme shapers of the environment around them in every possible way.
Geologist Jess Phoenix. She's co-founder of the environmental science nonprofit called Blueprint Earth and author of Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. We invite you to join with us here at BYU Radio in performing 10,000 acts of service. That's our goal. And the way you do this is you pick something to do and you do it. And you do it well, of course, you being you. We just would love to have you go to the website justserve.org for great ideas. You can also find volunteer opportunities right in your own zip code, justserve.org. Italy has its Mount Etna, but it also has something else people think of as really hot. Truffles. Remember that old conventional wisdom that truffle hunting takes pigs? Well, we also don't swallow 8 spiders annually in our sleep. We're going to do a gentle corrective to this pig business by inserting dogs into the picture. The world's most expensive fungus. That's on Constant Wonder.